Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Godfrey against Georgia. Holmes, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, this is a death penalty case out of the state of Georgia. I represent Mr. Robert Franklin Godfrey, who was convicted of murder in the first degree in the killings of his wife and his mother-in-law. It is hereby writ of certiorari from the Georgia Supreme Court. The issue, as framed by this court in this case, is whether, in affirming the death sentence in this case, has the Georgia Supreme Court adopted such a broad and vague construction of Section 27-2534.1b7 as to violate the 8th and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Section B7 is one of 10 aggravating circumstances that are the statutory guides to jurors in imposing the death sentence at sentencing phase of the Georgia proceedings. Now, before getting into the merits of the construction of Section B7 by the Georgia court, I wouldn't want to dwell too long, but I think it would be important to cover the facts in this case. This defendant, Mr. Godfrey, and his wife, the record shows, had a stormy marriage. He had been committed by her on three previous occasions to the state mental hospital in Milledgeville, Georgia. They had had a violent argument early in September of 1977, and she had left the house after he had threatened her in a drunken rage. After about a week, wife had filed divorce proceedings and had moved in with her mother, who was urging her to go ahead and finally put an end to this marriage. Now, the defendant had worked for approximately 20 years at the Batty State Northwest Regional Hospital as a surgical nurse and a postoperative male nurse. He had been to work that day, and his mother-in-law had called him at the hospital to tell him that his wife wanted to speak to him that evening. The defendant testified that led him to expect that he was, or to hope that he was going to be able to reconcile this situation, as he had been able to do in the past. His commitments to the state mental hospital in the past had been voluntary, part of which was the condition for reconciliation with his wife. When he got home, his wife did in fact call him. They had a rather violent argument, could not reach any kind of agreement on reconciliation or any of the divorce issues. She hung up, told him that she'd call back later to see if they could discuss it further. He testified that that affected him deeply, that he was put into a very depressed state. After the second phone conversation, which was even more heated, and she finally hung up on him. He testified at that point that he blanked out. He had had somewhat of a history that's in the record of blackouts in the past. The record substantiates that he then proceeded to get his shotgun, go down the hill to where the mother-in-law's trailer was, about 100, 200 yards away, came up behind the trailer, fired one shot through the back window, killing his wife instantly, came into the trailer, hit his daughter as she was going out on the head, causing several stitches, went into the trailer, reloading the shotgun, and shot his mother-in-law in the head as well, creating a very gory scene inside the trailer, which the prosecutor in the case portrayed by color pictures, even though he had black and white pictures of the same scenes in his file. The petitioner then called the sheriff's office, told them what he had done, told them to come get him. They asked him where he was. He explained where he was. He then goes outside the trailer, places the shotgun in the branches of an apple tree, and then sits down under a shade tree to await the arrival of the police. When the police get there, he tells them that they're dead, it's all over with, and shows one officer where he has placed the gun. And he's taken into custody, taken downtown, as in the county police building, in the presence of one officer. He's allegedly told him that he had done a heinous thing and had thought about it for a long time and would do it again. At the trial, Dr. Davis, a psychiatrist from Atlanta with quite impressive credentials, testified in behalf of the defendant. He had seen the defendant twice pursuant to court order, had also treated the defendant back in the 60s in Rome, where the defendant worked in the hospital there. The second session with Dr. Davis was for the purpose of a sodium amytal interview, truth serum, to aid the psychiatrist in his diagnosis of the mental state, and I suppose also to determine the credibility of the defendant's story. The psychiatrist concluded that at the time of the second phone call and the blackout of the defendant, that the defendant had been impelled by the immense emotional provocation that he felt about the breakup of his marriage into what he described as a dissociative reaction, and admitted on cross-examination that that state is an altered state of consciousness, but that the defendant probably would have known right from wrong, but would not have been able to consciously control his actions, that it is a type of psychiatric condition where suppressed feelings are played out in a sort of an automatic fashion without real conscious control over it. The state had psychiatric testimony from Milledgeville Hospital with some also the records of the defendant's previous incarceration down there.
Well, these things you're telling us, Mr. Holmes, were advanced to persuade the jury to a contrary conclusion, I take it. The jury did not accept this defense, did they?
They did not accept the defense of temporary insanity. They were advanced for two purposes, to try to establish the lack of criminal intent and also for purposes of mitigation. We felt that we were this was a case that ought to get a life sentence. Felt that the prosecutor should not have requested the death sentence, but that testimony was really going more to the mitigation. our psychiatric witness admitted that it was a non-psychotic condition, and they equated a psychotic condition with insanity. So I think the jury, by that concession, concluded that there was no real insanity defense. Now, when the prosecutor argued during the sentencing phase to the jury under Section B7, which was the only aggravating circumstance submitted to the jury, which is as follows, that the offense of murder was outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, or inhuman, in that it involves torture, depravity of mind, or an aggravated battery to the victim.
Mr. Holmes, you're attacking the statute. I've been waiting for you to get to it.
Yes, sir.
And where are the soft words in the statute that you feel are improper? Is it depravity of mind, or is it outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, or inhuman, or both?
I think it's both, Your Honor. Depravity of mind is not involved in this case. As a matter of fact, there's a case decided at the same time as Godfrey, Holton versus State, that in which the Georgia Supreme Court expressed the opinion in dicta that if a circumstance was only composed of depravity of mind, that would probably be insufficient under the Furman decision.
There were some factors here, weren't there? I take it they weren't argued. But the fact that the killing was before the young child, the fact that there were two murders, not one, two, and the fact that, I think it's a fact, that he forced the victim, the second victim, to anticipate being killed.
That's true.
Were those argued at all?
The first killing was in the presence of the child. She ran out. The second killing there would have had to have been a few seconds. There was anticipation of death as far as the mother-in-law was concerned, but I believe that I think what you're getting at is whether or not that, as one Georgia case is held, is sufficient to find torture. I don't think momentary anticipation of death is what's contemplated by the word torture. The Georgia Supreme Court has not specifically held that. They have held one case that is similar to that.
Well, at least these aren't specifically in the statute, this kind of thing. Killing somebody in front of a young child.
Your Honor, that...
Suppose this were listed as an aggravating circumstance in the statute. Would it be constitutional?
Well, Your Honor, they are non-statutory aggravating circumstances at present and could not be the basis for a death sentence. Now, whether or not... if there was an aggravating circumstance number 11 that said if you commit two first-degree murders in the same transaction, then that permits the imposition of the death sentence. I would think that without a chance to analyze it, that would probably be specific enough. Would certainly be as specific as some of the other.
Don't you get to a certain point where you have to use general language just because of the instances mentioned by Mr. Justice Blackmun? It's simply impossible to foresee all the manners in which killings can take place. And you have to use some fairly general rubric in order to express what you mean over and above murder in the first degree.
Well, I think that that's of course true. The goal of perfection in this type instance would be very difficult to reach, but the prosecutor in this case told the jury that torture was not involved and that aggravated battery was not involved in this case. So, and the jury only found a partial finding of B7. They found
that was outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, and inhuman. Now, those terms, and the court approved that. There's another case cited in the brief where a jury found under Section B-7 that the offense was both horrible and inhuman. So our argument is that the authoritative construction of Section B-7 by the Georgia Supreme Court is that that language standing alone is sufficient. In other words, they have construed this to the effect that the B-7 is really only composed of vile, horrible, and inhuman. And we feel strongly that that is no standard at all. That is totally subjective. It is certainly has no objective component in it to make review rational.
Well, what if the Georgia legislature, instead of saying vile, wanton, and inhuman, had said committed in front of a small child or committed on a second person 10 seconds after it was committed on the first person, which you say would not comprise torture, would that satisfy your objections?
Well, that'd be a wholly different case, Your Honor, but if they chose to get that specific and they described a particular type murder and the facts of the case fit that description, the question here is whether the aggravating circumstance can provide any guidance to channel the discretion of jurors. Under that standard, by describing a crime very specifically, and the facts meet that crime very specifically, you have a standard that can be reasonably followed by a jury.
My point is that just the range of human experience suggests that you're not going to have a whole catalog before you of the circumstances over and above first-degree murder, which may lead to a permissible capital offense, and that some generalization is necessary.
It may be, Your Honor, but I think it has to be qualified by some objective portion. If you take this Section B-7 as a whole, leaving torture and aggravated battery in it, that's something that you can point to that can be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And the standard in the sentencing phase is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, are you telling us that shooting at about a 5 or 6 foot range with a shotgun, blowing the head off of a victim in the presence of two other potential victims, one of whom became a victim, is not an aggravated battery?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that it, under the Georgia statute, an aggravated battery is the depriving of a member, and if the top of the head is a member of the body, then that
just
fits the
description. Two people of their heads.
Yes, sir.
That's certainly at least as bad as chopping off an arm or a leg, isn't it?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, because you can live if you just lost an arm, but that gets into some close questions of definition.
I was trying to get at. Do you say that the phrase in the statute, aggravated battery, does not embrace what took place here?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that it could conceivably embrace it, but the jury did not find it, and the Georgia Supreme Court upheld the partial finding and in effect said that the jury's phraseology in finding it vile, horrible, and inhuman only was not objectionable.
Suppose this, instead of being a shotgun murder, had been just a clean single-shot pistol through the heart. Would you not be here making the same argument?
If the jury had made the same partial finding and under the entire circumstances, and if the Georgia court had held that that was a sufficient standard or that was a sufficient finding, in effect saying that that composes a standard, yes, sir.
The implication of my inquiry, of course, is whether any first-degree murder under the Georgia theory would fit B-7. Anyone.
Certainly, as it has been construed in this case, any first-degree murder and any loss of life under the common common definitions is going to be vile, horrible, and inhuman. It encompasses the range entirely of first-degree murder. I don't know how it couldn't be found to be.
Well, didn't can't we assume reasonably that a jury could have reasonably thought it fit these adjectives because it was in effect an execution committed in the presence of the next victim and even a possible third victim? Apart from the manner, whether it was injection of some drug or shooting with the shotgun or a clean rifle bullet, the very nature of the staging of it, an execution-style murder, doesn't that fall within the language vile, outrageous, wanton?
Yes, sir. It's horrible and it's inhuman as well. But every other murder is. Every other murder is.
Well, but this statute apparently reaches out for something that's a little more than just an ordinary killing, as yes. was suggested by a clean bullet shot through the heart. And isn't that what this statute is trying to reach?
I think that was the intent of the statute, Your Honor. But I think it has been construed in a totally open-ended fashion. It has not been narrowed by definition as
whether it's construed somewhere else that way is not relevant to this case. How it was applied in this case is all we're concerned with, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the issue is in this case as to whether or not Section B-7 has been unconstitutionally construed on its face, as well as the issue of whether it's just simply been unconstitutionally applied.
But I thought you had just agreed that this was outrageous, vile, horrible, and inhuman. You didn't agree on the aggravated battery part, but you've agreed that as to these parts, it fits the statute, the events of this case. Did I misunderstand you?
No, Your Honor, but I did qualify that answer by saying that if you ask me that question about any murder, I would agree.
Well, it isn't a question of whether we agree here. It's a question of what a jury could reasonably conclude.
Your Honor, I think one problem that's pointed up by this is that the standard as construed by the Georgia court here is so vague and overbroad that it is not capable of rational and objective review. Of course, it could fit this circumstance. It could fit any number of other circumstances across the range of first-degree murder. And factors in this case that are non-statutory aggravating circumstances cannot, under the statute, be sufficient to impose the death penalty. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Very well. Mr. Holmes, Mr. Dunsmore.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In 1973, the General Assembly of Georgia, in response to this Court's decision in Furman, and looking at Furman, felt that the states could still inflict a death penalty, providing the manner in which they did so set forth certain articulate standards. In March of 1978, a jury in Polk County found that one of these standards had been complied with based upon the state's case and imposed a death penalty under the seventh aggravating circumstance. This is a case of premeditated murder. The district attorney, on that basis, sought the death penalty. I'd like to briefly discuss some of the facts in light of counsel's going over those facts. While there was an altercation between the petitioner and his wife some 3 weeks prior to the fatal shootings, that altercation also involved violence, and it also involved a weapon capable of producing death, a knife. On two occasions, on the 5th of September, the petitioner drew a knife on his wife the first time to make her remained seated at a couch in their house, and the second time actually used that knife on his wife in a bathroom in which he cut her clothes to and through some of her underclothing, although there was no apparent physical injury as a result of that.
That might bear on whether he should have been acquitted or found guilty by reason of insanity or in mitigation, but what's it got to do with the issue?
All right,
now?
I think it has to do with the issue in this matter, in that it shows a predisposition on behalf of the petitioner in view of his later statement following the shootings where he said, I've done a hideous crime, I've thought about it for 8 years, and I'd do it again, or I was glad that I did it. We need to take into consideration the fact that even though there had been some phone conversations between the petitioner and his wife, there appears to be a sufficient interval which the jury considered where there would have been a cooling off of any passions. The killing takes place at night. The petitioner is able to lurk in the back of this trailer, has the advantage of lights on so that he can silhouette, pick out his target. He used what was called an over and under shotgun combination rifle. That means he could have used the rifle, but he chose instead to use a shotgun. And it's pretty hard at 5 or 6 feet to miss with a broad pattern of a shotgun.
What gauge was it?
I'm not too sure. I think it was a 20 gauge. I believe that's 20 gauge over and under. But he had that option.
You think that option made all the difference in the world in this case under your statute?
Mr. Justice Blackmun, no, I'm not too sure, but I think it is an essential fact because I think what makes this case outrageously and wantonly violent and inhuman is the cold-blooded, calculated course of action which the petitioner embarked in from the beginning with an avowed purpose to cause death. The type of weapon he used is evidence of his intention of inflicting a fatal injury.
That, you can say about the same thing with any premeditated murder, can't you?
Well, yes, but the statute, the seventh aggravating statute, as defined by our court in Harris, looks to, as they said, the core, not the core, but the core cases, like Pitless, like they use in State versus Dixon in Florida. We're not looking at the common killing, as Mr. Chief Justice Berger suggested. We're looking at a killing where there was an avowed, you know, a conscientious decision made sometime even before he arrived at the trailer to inflict grievous bodily harm.
Isn't now, that normal for first-degree murder?
That's true, but this seventh aggravating circumstance looks at the more heinous aspects of it. Now, there can be some overlapping.
Will you give me a murder that's not heinous?
Well, I think that they are all taking of any life would be is unfortunate.
First-degree murder.
First-degree. No, they're senseless killings. But some are more senseless than others, particularly where there is no avenue of escape. That is, there's no right to defend, no opportunity to defend against this course of action at all.
But don't you make your point when you say he planned it a year in advance and after the events said that he'd do it again if he had the chance?
I believe that goes a far way in making our points, sir. I really do.
All murders are not accompanied by that kind of a before and after sequence, are they?
That is correct. And I think that's what makes this case so outrageously or wantonly vile. For example, the outrageous nature of the case is the fact that it's heinous and atrocious and it offends human standards on the basis that these individuals, had no opportunity to defend themselves. We have the wantonless, that is the aspect of the merciless killing, where he comes in, they're in a trailer, a small area. We certainly do have torture in the terms of the anticipation of death, as we argued in our brief, which is a mental torture. I think the statute could include that. And our Supreme Court in the Floyd case involving an armed robbery, double execution style killing, where the mother and daughter were separated for the purposes of determining where the money was in the house, paraded the individuals around the house, and then before second killing, the daughter witnesses her mother being killed, knowing that she's next on the list, so to speak. And in this case, the evidence shows that when the wife was shot in the head, and I think that's another point that shows premeditation, both victims were shot in the head, not like trying to get them out of the way or just to do some injury to them, in intent.
Could I ask two questions? One,
yes,
on
sir.
The deliberate character of it. That's an essential element of the offense itself, isn't it?
That is correct. Right.
The second question I had is the charge of the court directed the jury to designate in writing the aggravating circumstances or circumstances which you found beyond reasonable doubt. Then the next page of the record shows the form of verdict they returned, and it says that the offense of murder was outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, and inhuman, and doesn't go on and say in that it involved depravity of mind and the like. The question I'm unclear on is this the jury's language or is this a form that the judge gave to them that was pre-typed and they just signed?
I believe that this was the form that was given to them prepared by the prosecutor. Although
is that a proper form? Is that the form? Wouldn't it be? I wonder why it didn't track the language of the statute and the language of the instruction then.
I don't know, but on page 79, the judge instructs
79
of the appendix instructed the complete language of the statute.
That was given orally, but the instruction didn't go to the jury in writing, did it?
It usually does, and that's the proceeding that usually goes out in writing because they must designate. And it's a possibility, for example, in some cases, more than one statutory aggravating circumstance may be submitted to the jury. For example, it's conceivable under the facts in this case that they could have found in the course of one of the murders.
The other question, just so I get it all out, you have an opportunity to comment. On the top of page 86, which is the part of the judge's form, which apparently accompanies the record on appeal, the offense of murder, he strikes the things that he instructed the jury on, says the offense of murder, and they strike some language out, was outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, and he changes the order, and inhuman, in that it involved torture and so forth. You see the first one under the G there?
Yes, sir.
And then there are brackets around the first part of it. And the brackets correspond with the jury's verdict, and the remainder corresponds with the instruction. Is it fair to infer that those brackets were inserted by the judge?
I think that's the only thing that we could infer.
Do you attach any significance to them?
The only significance that I don't attach any significance to it, other than the fact, and I can't explain why he may have put those there, other than maybe it was a mental exercise when he was trying to parrot the jury's finding as appears on page 80 of the appendix. In examining this case as to the...
Could I just interrupt you one more in response to, or in connection with Mr. Justice Stevens' inquiry? Certainly on pages 80 and 81, the presence of the alternative at the top on each page to fix the punishment of life would indicate this is a printed form of some kind, or at least a type form submitted to the jury. And... what is your Georgia law when he instructs that they shall designate in writing the aggravating circumstances and they don't, other than just to use the form?
I'm not too sure I understand your question, Mr. Justice.
Well, you feel that the jury, in returning that form in each case, complied with the instructions that you shall designate in writing the aggravating circumstances which you found beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't see any circumstances designated other than stating that the offense of murder was outrageously or wantonly vile.
I think they did comply with it, and the reason I'd say they complied with it in that they found, or the instruction was submitted to them in this form, and I think there's two reasons why, or basically one reason perhaps why they should designate in writing and why the court also submits for them for their guidance. And that probably is that when jurors are given instructions, there's a lot that they have to remember. In a death case, we want to make sure that the jury's discretion is channeled and that they find within the terms of the whatever aggravating circumstance or circumstances are given to them. And I believe that's generally the reason why the prosecutors prepare the a form ahead of time for the jurors. It's to assist them in arriving at their to make sure they use the language of the statute.
Well, they didn't use all of the language of the statute. No, now, the original record is lodged in the court here, I take it.
That's correct.
Will that include the two sheets of paper that were signed by the jury foreman and to which that would, Mr. Justice that, Blackmun was referring?
That would, Mr. Chief Justice. That
and
would be.
Will it tell us whether those were typed up at the direction of the jurors, the foreman, or how they happened to be prepared?
I don't believe it would tell us how they were prepared, that is, whether they were typed up at the direction of the judge, the state's attorney, or by the jurors. I believe that if they are in writing, and my memory escaped me because I've been reading from the appendix, if they were in writing, more than likely
in longhand, you mean?
Longhand, probably by the jury, and if they were typed out ahead of time, most likely prepared by the district attorney who presided over the case.
Mr. Attorney General, looking at page 80 and 81, which are the two verdicts, would you tell me whether the jury found that the conduct was outrageously or that the conduct was wantonly? Now, which was it, according to them?
Well, they found
which
all of
it. Which was it, according to this? They found it was one or the other.
Well, the statute.
Did something in one or the other?
They found all of that. I know it's used in the word
well,
conjunctive
form. They didn't say outrageously and wantonly. They said outrageously or wantonly.
All right, and I believe the words outrageously or wantonly are somewhat synonymous.
And that's the normal language used in America's Georgia.
Well, this wasn't in America's. This was in Cedartown, but...
Well, in Cedartown, is that normal? Did something outrageously statute. And wantonly?
Outrageous or wantonly?
Or did this come straight from the judge's charge?
Well, the judge's charge uses those words. The statute uses those words.
So the finding that either or is a sufficient finding under Georgia law, that the man is either guilty or not guilty, or what? Where do you have a finding that uses or?
I'm not too sure I understand your question, Mr. Justice
well, I
Marshall,
asked you
but.
Whether it was outrageously or wantonly. And you can't answer me.
Well, the terms outrageously and wantonly, both in the statute and in that form, are adjectives to the terms, the words vile, horrible, or inhuman, are they not?
That is correct.
Now I ask you, is it one or the other?
I think it's all of them, although it could be one or the other, but I think it's all of them.
And
that's
what. Sufficient to take a man's life?
Well, it's sufficient to take a man's life when the facts support that beyond a reasonable doubt, which we contend they do support beyond a reasonable doubt.
The court in Gregg rejected a constitutional attack on the seventh aggravating circumstance per se, didn't it?
Mr. Justice, Stewart, if I recall in the opinion, as the court said, we find no reason to believe that it would be applied too broadly or in too vague.
And therefore we rejected the constitutional attack upon it.
That's correct.
Per se, on its
per
language.
Se. I would say because the jury in Gregg did not even return that aggravating circumstances.
Which would include the outrageously, the disjunctive that Mr. Justice Marshall has just
right. I don't believe that.
About the question that was presented in this case.
Well, that's what the statute says, outrageously or wantonly.
Well, then I would wonder why we granted cert in this case.
General Dunsmore, I take it that the typical sentencing or the charging form in a capital case in Georgia, the judge is not obligated. In fact, it probably would be error to charge on all of the 10 statutory aggravating circumstances. For instance, I know Section 1 says it's an aggravating circumstance if the murder was committed by a person who has a substantial history of serious assaultive criminal convictions. Now, if the defendant who was being tried did not have such a history, the judge wouldn't submit that to the jury, would he?
That's correct, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. He only submits those aggravating circumstances which the prosecutor has put the defendant on notice that he would seek the death penalty on. Only those. It may be one, it may be two, and I suppose in some instances it could be three. But I think
that in this case, and the prosecutor, in at least in his closing argument, said that this didn't involve torture or an aggravated battery within the definition of the statute, but only outrageously or wantonly vile in that it displayed some depravity of mind. That was the argument.
That's correct, and that was what those are the words, and it's in the appendix. Mm-hmm. That's how he phrased it. But I think it's important to keep
in
mind.
Did he give notice to you say the prosecutor gives notice to the defendant as to the aggravating circumstance?
That's correct.
But he just says like seven.
Generally, I would say
he
that
he didn't give formal notice to the defendant.
Well, I'm
as precisely as he argued to the jury.
That I don't know, but I would not say that he'd have to set out word for word. I think it's sufficient to put him on notice that I'm seeking the death penalty under the second aggravating circumstance, the seventh aggravating circumstance, and I can't conceive of any incident where any lawyer appointed would not, if he didn't know what number two or number seven was, would not go and look at the statute in Title 27 to see just exactly what it involved.
Let me interrupt you again. I take it this report or this form of the trial judge, is this made out and it goes to the appellate court in your state?
That's correct, Mr. Justice Blackmun.
One thing that is of interest to me, and I hadn't noticed it before, was this is question, I think it's 21, was the victim physically harmed or tortured? Answer, no. And if yes, state extent of harm or torture, and he answers that saying, excluding the actual murdering of the two victims. Now, I don't know whether that's a formal finding which would exclude your argument or insinuation anyway as to torture here.
I don't think it would, because I think this is the judge's, how he puts it in his own terms. He makes an evaluation to go along, and this goes with the record for the Georgia Supreme Court to review.
He's informing his charge, obviously, because of that bracket that's on page 86.
That's correct. And there may be, and there probably is some inconsistency, because I think the facts would show there is some torture, at least the anticipation of death as to the mother-in-law. And perhaps the judge at that time, many of us think of torture in the terms of the McCorkadale sense or the Dick sense, where you're taking a knife or cutting
the
person.
Here's what the prosecutor said. You know what the prosecutor said. He's in his closing argument on page 75 of the appendix. Of course, you cannot find there was torture. There wasn't any torture. That's his argument to the jury. And suggesting that the jury nevertheless thought there might be torture in here?
It could be, because the jury takes the law, not from the district attorney in his argument, but from the judge.
We resume there at 1 o'clock, counsel.